whispered to Megan, "We can't lose." "We can't lose," Anthony Costello said, his voice clear and strong, his eyes on the network cameras. "Dr. Wright is an innocent man, wrongfully accused and wrongfully imprisoned." Shutters clicked. Motor drives whirred. Cameras loved his face. Square, rugged, utterly masculine, perpetually tanned. His eyes were the color of espresso, set deep beneath the ledge of his brow. He had long ago perfected a piercing stare that could make witnesses crumble and jurors sway. He stood on the front steps of the Campion Sons of Norway Hall, the wind ruffling his jet-black hair. The cameras had to shoot up to get him, an angle that made him look taller than 5'10", and emphasized the solid squareness of his build, and the excellent hand-tailored cut of his black wool topcoat. He would have preferred to make his first statements to the press regarding his new client in front of the Park County Courthouse, because he liked the symbolism of storming the halls of justice. But the press was in Campion, covering the second child abduction, so he had gone with Plan B. It was the mark of a good defense attorney to be flexible, to be adaptable. He had to be able to shift on the run, think on his feet. He had begun to formulate a strategy for the defense the moment he had accepted Garrett Wright as a client. He wanted to strike hard and fast at the media, grab their attention, and keep it on him. The kidnapping of Dustin Holloman was a terrible tragedy, but Costello had also seen it immediately as the opportunity it was. Naturally, he felt sympathy for the family, in the way one might feel sympathy for fictional characters in a movie. He couldn't allow the feeling to become more personal than that. It was essential for him to put their tragedy in a perspective that would potentially be of some benefit to his client. "My client sits in jail, his reputation suffering more with every passing hour, while a madman stalks the children of Park County," he said. "The investigation of the kidnapping in Deer Lake was mishandled from the start. As a result, there have been needless deaths. An innocent man has been incarcerated, and now another family has been torn apart." The reporters clamored for his attention, barking out questions, thrusting microphones up at him. He gave the answer he wanted to give, not caring whether the question had been asked. "I'm here in Park County to see that justice will be done." Soundbite extraordinaire. "I'm here in Campion as an emissary for my client to offer his deepest concern to the family of little Dustin Holloman. I know Dr. Wright would want me to extend a personal plea to the kidnappers to return Dustin unharmed." He knew no such thing, of course. He had yet to speak directly to Garrett Wright. It was unlikely Wright had even heard about the kidnapping. For all Costello knew, Wright was a cold-hearted son of a bitch who wouldn't have felt a second's pity if all the children in Campion were torn from their families and carted off to concentration camps. It didn't matter. As of this moment, the press would look upon his client as a compassionate man, with a deep, abiding respect for families, for the law, for America. "Who do you blame for botching the Kirkwood investigation?" He frowned in the general direction of the reporter who had shouted the question. "I think there's blame enough to go around, don't you?" Not having paid close attention to the case from the outset, he had spent 6 hours last night going over news clippings from both major dailies in Minneapolis and St. Paul. He had watched videos of newscasts and interviews, absorbing as much as he could about the principal players, though he wasn't ready yet to single anyone out for public castigation. The female BCA agent was sleeping with the chief of police. A convicted pedophile had been working at the ice arena, then killed himself while in custody. A mummified cadaver had been found in the garage of a church deacon who had eluded capture for 2 days, then fell to his death before he could be apprehended. There were enough plot twists for a soap opera, which was exactly what had caught the attention of the networks and the tabloids. Immune to everyday crime, they sought the sensational, the kind of stuff writers were paid for in Hollywood. It was so much cheaper to get it from real life. "But though there has been a gross miscarriage of justice," Costello went on, "I want it made clear that Dr. Wright himself bears no grudges. He still has trust in our justice system and faith that the truth will out and he will be exonerated. Just as we all must have faith that the kidnapper of Dustin Holloman and Josh Kirkwood will be found and punished, that justice will be swift and sure. On that glorious note, Costello stepped down from his impromptu podium and moved quickly through the crowd toward his waiting black Lincoln town car, his staff clearing the path for him. He had brought with him an associate, a legal assistant, and a personal assistant who was also his driver. Another of his associates had been sent ahead to Deer Lake for the purpose of leasing an office suite. It would be far inferior to his offices in the IDS Tower in downtown Minneapolis, but it would serve the purpose. He believed it was important to establish a presence, like a show of muscle before a fight. It would also be easier to have a base of operations in the town rather than try to do everything long distance. By the end of the day, the Deer Lake office would have a full complement of business machines, and one of his secretaries would be hard at work. "Excellent presentation, Mr. Costello," Dorman said, a fellow Purdue alumnus. Dorman was 27, sharp, but not ambitious, more interested in being secure than in being famous, comfortable to learn at Costello's elbow, work like a dog, and take none of the credit, all of which made him ideal for his job. Costello chose his people carefully, with just such things in mind. He accepted no associates with Ivy League educations, because he had not been able to afford one himself, and he did not want any snotty, silver-spoon rich kids who felt they were socially superior to him, nor did he want his office projecting an image of elitism. He was himself the product of a middle-class, blue-collar upbringing, and proud of it. In choosing associates, he hired primarily family men, none of them taller than he was. Sensitive to society's current mania for political correctness, he had peppered his staff with an assortment of women and minorities. Levine, the legal assistant who sat in the front seat ahead of him, was an equal opportunity triple score, a black Jewish woman. He was careful to select female staff members who were neither unattractive nor beautiful. Everything in the offices of Anthony Costello, from plants to personnel, had been selected by Costello to showcase Costello. That was the way image was made. And in today's world, image was everything. Image was perceived as success. Success bred greater success. Success opened the doors of opportunity that led to fame. Opportunity had to be seized and wrung out for all it was worth. Levine turned sideways in her seat and handed a neatly folded copy of the St. Paul Pioneer Press back to him. "Here's the article on the death of Judge Franken, Mr. Costello." The story was situated directly below the continuation of the front-page piece concerning Garrett Wright's bond hearing, as if one event had led to the other. A photograph the size of a postage stamp portrayed Franken in his robes. He looked like an apple-head doll that had begun to rot. A second, much larger photo depicted the chaos in the courtroom where Franken had died, a group of people huddled over an indistinct form on the floor. The focus of the picture was on one familiar face that had turned to glare at the cameras. J. Butler Brooks. Costello hummed a note to himself. A Cheshire Cat smile creased the corners of his mouth. "I've got a call in to the district assignments clerk," Dorman said, "to find out what kind of delay we can expect."
"Don't be passive, Dorman," Costello said. "We won't expect a delay. We'll demand there be none."
His associate's brows rose. A pair of beige hyphens, barely discernible from his skin tone.
"We could use the extra time to prepare."
"The prosecution would use the extra time to prepare," Costello clarified. "Wright was arrested Saturday night. Prior to his arrest, he had not been a suspect. I can guarantee you the county attorney's office is scrambling to put their case together. Should we allow them extra time to do that, Mr. Dorman?"
"No, sir."
"No, sir," he echoed, his gaze drifting out the window, his memory drifting back in time. "Hit 'em hard, hit 'em fast," he murmured. "We'll have this case dismissed before Ellen North can turn around."
Chapter 11.
"But though there has been a gross miscarriage of justice, I want it made clear that Dr. Wright himself bears no grudges. He still has trust in our justice system, and faith that the truth will out and he will be exonerated. Just as we all must have faith that the kidnapper of Dustin Holloman and Josh Kirkwood will be found and punished. That justice will be swift and sure. Jay clicked off the 19-inch color television that sat on the carton it had come in. Costello vanished, but the smell of his game lingered like bad gas. Jay knew the game plan well enough. He had employed it himself in his brief life as a defense attorney. Costello would attack where and when he could, create opportunities if he had to. He would paint a glowing portrait of his client that would bear only a passing resemblance to the man and slam the opposition with every kind of accusation he could think of. It was a game of diversion that tied in quite neatly with the kidnappers, as it happened. Nice coincidence that they were all on the same team. He took a last deep drag off his cigarette and threw the butt into the fireplace that was gray with the dust of ashes long since swept away. His sudden pilgrimage to Deer Lake had left him without many options in the way of accommodations. There wasn't a hotel room to be had for miles. All of them were filled with reporters. Furnished apartments were the domain of Harris College students who were just returning to classes after their winter break. Impatient and unconcerned with the cost, he had taken this house. He needed to work, to immerse himself in a world that had no connection with a life he had so abruptly left in Alabama. It didn't matter what it cost him in terms of cash. He would have paid anything to make the fresh memories fade into oblivion. Lobotomy and alcoholism, while they would certainly have dulled the pain, were not viable alternatives. Work was the best thing he could find. Why he had chosen this particular case in which to lose himself was a question he chose to ignore. "And you don't find that just the least bit twisted, escaping into someone else's real-life tragedy?" "It's just a story," he repeated to himself the pat answer he had given Ellen, knowing there was more. Still, he clung to the lie for his own sanity's sake. The case was timely and fascinating. Writing about it was his job, and he was damn good at it. And so, he had come to Deer Lake. With such blind, desperate haste that he hadn't packed much more than a change of underwear. Dismissing the temptation to self-analyze, he turned his attention to his surroundings. Overpriced by Deer Lake standards, the house had been on the market long enough that the owners had gratefully accepted 3 months' exorbitant rent and turned over the keys and the burden of heating the place. As yet, he had been unsuccessful in warming it up. Even with the thermostat cranked into the 70s, the room seemed cold, as if furniture and family were required for the warmth to stay, instead of sailing up through the roof to be swallowed greedily by the cold. He had set himself up entirely in the living room, because the huge stone fireplace at least suggested warmth. Unfortunately, the owners had seen fit to take all fireplace tools and accoutrements with them, including the grate. There wasn't so much as a stick of kindling or a kitchen match, let alone a neat stack of fake logs ready to glow with a flick of a switch. He stood and tried to stretch the kinks out of his back that had set in from sleeping in a sleeping bag on the floor. His gaze did a slow scan of the room, automatically comparing it to Ellen's cozy living room. Here, there was only emptiness and impermanence. Instead of overstuffed armchairs, he had badly strung long chairs that had been left in the garage. Instead of a cherrywood coffee table, he had a pair of 8-foot fold-down rent-all tables with fake wood-grain tops. Instead of folk art and potted plants, he had leased office equipment, a laser printer, copier, fax and answering machine. The tables were strewn with file folders and news clippings. His laptop computer sat open and ready, its screen blank, waiting for him to fill it with words that would bring this story to life for the hundreds of thousands of people who read his books. He turned away from it and went to the kitchen for a fresh cup of coffee, from the coffee maker that sat beside the box it had come in. He had stocked the cupboards with paper plates and cups, the refrigerator with beer, the freezer with pizzas and frozen entrees. Since his divorce 5 years previous, He had left cuisine to restaurant chefs. Cooking a meal for himself only reminded him he had no one to share it with. Not that he missed Christine. He occasionally mourned the loss of the girl she had once been. Pretty, sweet, undemanding. The wife who had left him was another matter. In retrospect, they had been mismatched from the first. Christine had a deep-seated need for stability. He was impetuous and reckless. The bright, hot love that had sprung up between them had quickly cooled and soured to frustration. Frustration fostered resentment. Resentment bred pain. With pain came disillusionment. And hate. She must have hated me. She must still. The thoughts he had been trying to hold at bay for the last week crept in. They were never far from the surface when he was tired. He cursed his ex-wife for coming back into his life for those few days last week, however accidental their meeting might have been. He had long been over Christine, but he didn't know that he would ever get over what she had done to him without his consent or knowledge. In his mind's eye, he saw the boy standing beside her, with his thick shock of brown hair and sky-blue eyes. She must have hated me. She must still. Sipping at the coffee that was strong enough to take the finish off the kitchen cabinets, he wandered through the empty dining room and back to his base of operations. With 4 bedrooms, 3 baths, and a living room with a 2-story cathedral ceiling, the house was certainly more than he needed, but not more than he was accustomed to. His home, on the outskirts of Eudora, was twice this size, a reproduction plantation-era mansion that made the Brooks's ancestral home look like a tacky bungalow. He had built it to impress, and to inspire jealousy, and to flaunt his success in the faces of the people who had always pegged him as his generation's bad Brooks, destined to dereliction and drunkenness. He lived in a fraction of it, and the ostentation of the place meant nothing to him on a personal level. He would have been just as satisfied living in a 2-bedroom apartment. He wasn't sure what that meant, considering he had never in his life felt satisfied. There had been a restlessness within him since boyhood and before. All his life, his mother had taken great delight in complaining about what a restless baby he had been. So impatient to be born, he had come 2 weeks early and hadn't bothered to wait for the doctor.
"You hit the ground running, boy,"
Uncle Hooter had often said. Unfortunately, in all his Johnny Walker wisdom, Uncle Hooter had never given any indication of where or what he was supposed to be running to. Trouble had been the general consensus. And Jay had borne that out well enough. He had been a burden and a blight on the Brooks family name more times than he could count, and yet he always managed to come out smelling like a rose in the end, always twisting disaster into irony. He was the Brooks who had broken windows and minor laws and major traditions, the one who had forsaken Auburn, the Brooks family alma mater, since Christ was an undergraduate, for a baseball scholarship at Purdue. He was the one who had turned his nose up at the venerable old Brooks family law practice, the one whose wife had left him. But he was also the Brooks who had made a fortune and a name for himself, the Brooks who was courted by New York and Hollywood and had his face either on the cover or the inside of every known magazine in America. He was the black sheep whose exploits the family had criticized with relish, whose fame they accepted grudgingly, whose money they took without qualm. There was a book in there somewhere, but he had no desire to write it. He preferred digging for skeletons in the closets of perfect strangers, trying to make some sense of the twists and snags in their lives. And so, he had come to Deer Lake. "You're a mercenary profiteer no better than a vampire, a hack, looking to steal the lives and pain of real people to compensate for your own lack of a real imagination." Ellen's words echoed sharply in his mind. He told himself they didn't matter, that what she thought couldn't matter to him because he couldn't allow himself to get involved with her. He was here for a purpose, and it wasn't having sex with Ellen North. He stood at the big windows that rose to a peak in the main wall of the living room and stared out at the harsh white landscape. Ryan's Bay, the realtor had called it, though it wasn't a bay at all, but an area of sloughs out on the edge of nothing, west of the part of Deer Lake known to locals as Dinky Town. Whatever water the bay held lay secret beneath the dunes of snow, a frozen desert, bleak and uninviting. Blonde weeds and cattail stalks rose through the drifts to flutter in the bitter wind. The nearest house was a quarter mile off to the north, hidden by a thick stand of pine trees. To the east, he could see the last Deer Lake neighborhood that straggled out to the edge of the marsh and farm fields. Small square houses with smoke curling up from their chimneys into the winter white sky. The spires of St. Alysius Catholic Church rose above the rooftops, a pair of lances thrusting toward heaven. They seemed a long way from where he stood, though he reckoned it wasn't more than 3/4 of a mile. There was a sense of isolation here that had little to do with distance. Josh Kirkwood's jacket had been found out here, tucked in the weeds just off a trail used for snowmobiling and cross-country skiing. An older woman named Ruth Cooper had gone out with her dog to let him run, even though the wind chill factor that day had clocked in at 50 degrees below zero. The Labrador had dragged the jacket up from the weeds, and Ryan's Bay had become the focus of the search and the media. Jay could very clearly remember the news footage of Paul Kirkwood falling to his knees in the snow, his son's coat clutched in his hands while he sobbed, "Oh my God, Josh, Josh, oh God, no." He could still hear the anguish, could feel it run through him like a pike. For a fleeting second, he put himself in Paul Kirkwood's place and imagined the kind of wild, hot panic that would tear through him if all he had left of his own son was a jacket and a madman's twisted message. The emotion hit him with physical force, punishing, crushing, 9 times sharper than the pain he had brought here with him. He pushed it away, cursing himself for a masochist. He didn't need to feel what these people felt. He only needed to capture it on paper. With that squarely at the forefront of his mind, he abandoned his coffee, grabbed his coat, and headed for the door. The accounting firm of Christensen and Kirkwood was housed in a new 2-story square brick building that bore the grandiose name of the Omni Complex. According to the list of tenants in the foyer, the building also housed a real estate agency, an insurance agency, and a pair of small law firms. Christensen and Kirkwood was located on the second floor. Jay walked up, found the oak door with the appropriate stenciling job, and let himself into the outer office, which looked like 1,000 other outer offices he had been in. White walls hung with pseudo-southwestern artwork, the requisite potted palm, nondescript furnishings of oak and oatmeal-colored upholstery. A secretary with flame-red hair looked up questioningly from her computer terminal and gave a little jolt of recognition. "Is Mr. Kirkwood in?" Jay asked, flashing a smile. "Name's J. Butler Brooks. I'd take a minute or two of his time, if he's free." The secretary sucked in a little gasp of breath, her blue eyes round as silver dollars in her freckled face. Apparently rendered speechless, she popped up from her chair and disappeared into Paul Kirkwood's office. Jay eyed the small sofa, that had likely been picked more for the decor than comfort, and stayed on his feet. His own face stared up at him from the cover of an outdated People magazine on the oak coffee table. "Crime Czar, J. Butler Brooks pens arresting true crime and makes a killing in the process." People's penchant for puns never failed to make him cringe. "Mr. Brooks!" A handsome smile turned Paul Kirkwood's mouth as he strode out of his office. "It's a pleasure to meet you." Jay closed the distance between them. "I have a regrettable habit of dropping in on people. I hope this isn't an inconvenient time." "No, not at all." Kirkwood met Jay's handshake automatically, but his grip was uncertain. "Come on into my office. Would you like coffee, Mr. Brooks?" "No, thanks," Jay said. While Paul gave instructions for privacy to his secretary, Jay took a moment to survey the room, looking for clues about Josh's father. As in the outer office, the furnishings were oak with smooth, rounded modern lines. A framed print of wood ducks hung on one dark green wall. Another displayed diplomas and certificates. The office was neat and tidy. Compulsively so. If not for the open file on the desk, he would have thought he had walked into a display in a furniture store. The only sign of Paul Kirkwood living here was a neatly folded, green plaid blanket on the sofa. "I read in the paper about your performing CPR on Judge Franken," Paul said, as he entered the office and closed the door behind him. He was clean-shaven, his pinstriped white shirt neatly pressed, the crease in his brown trousers sharp. What a strange and unpleasant happening that must have been.
"Imagine how the judge must have felt about it," Jay said dryly.
A framed photograph in the bookcase caught his eye. Josh, in a too-big baseball uniform, Paul kneeling beside him with a proud and silly grin on his lean, handsome face. The image caught Jay unaware.
"Josh is quite the little athlete, huh?" he asked, nodding to the photo. "Baseball, hockey.
He was at hockey the night he was abducted, right?" "Yes, he plays wing on his squirts team. Hannah was supposed to pick him up that night, but she got hung up at the hospital." He spoke carefully, trying to keep the accusation out of his voice, but a hint of it remained, like a phantom coffee stain that wouldn't come out of a shirt. The feeling had become dyed into the fabric of the answer.
"I'm sorry for your pain," Jay said. "I can only imagine the toll this all has taken on you and your wife, and then to have the perpetrator turn out to be someone you knew and trusted. Must have been one hell of a shock."
"You don't know the half of it," Paul muttered.
"Let me tell you what I'm doing here, Mr. Kirkwood."
Jay walked around behind the desk and glanced out the narrow window that overlooked the parking lot full of cars crusted in winter grime.
"What's gone on here, what's going to go on here in bringing this case to trial, has got the interest of the nation," he said, turning around. "A crime like this one, in a small town, touches a lot of nerves. If a crime like this can happen here in Deer Lake, Minnesota, then it can happen anywhere. People want to feel they have some understanding of why that is, and what they might do to prevent it."
"You want to do a book about Josh's kidnapping?"
"Possibly. Probably. It's an intriguing story. Complicated. Compelling. I imagine it will prove to be only more so as the trial unfolds."
"And you'd like to make some kind of deal?" Jay looked up from his examination of the items meticulously arranged on the desk. There were dollar signs in Paul Kirkwood's deep-set hazel eyes.
"Deal?" Jay said, playing dumb.
Kirkwood shrugged. "Inside Edition offered me $100,000.
"And you're waiting for me to up the ante," Jay thought.
He had been through it all before. Sometimes victims threw him out of their houses, outraged at the very idea of a book about their ordeal. And sometimes they wanted him to compensate them for their suffering, as if he had perpetrated the crime himself, for the sole purpose of setting the scene for a book. And then, there were the Paul Kirkwoods of the world. Paul Kirkwood had greed oozing out of his pores like sweat.
"And Ellen thinks I'm the profiteer." "I don't do deals, Mr. Kirkwood. What I write is not a biography. This story will involve many people. If I grant any one of them a portion of the book, then I run the risk of having the story slanted to reflect their view of things. Contrary to what some might believe, I have ethics, and I do apply them."
"And your ethics don't include sharing the millions you'll make on a book?" Paul scowled at him, a look that was more petulance than menace. "I fail to see how you can publish a book about events in someone's life without compensating them."
"It's like this, Mr. Kirkwood. The crime, the trial, that's all a matter of public record. If you choose to talk to me, then I may include your point of view. If you choose not to, then I'm forced to form opinions based on the testimony of others and the records of the events that have taken place. It's your call."
"It's my life," Paul snapped. "I deserve..." Jay narrowed his eyes. "Josh is my son," he said, scrambling to cover his mistake. "He deserves something from this." Jay had made up his mind on that issue before he'd even climbed onto the plane to come to Minnesota. He would set up a trust for Josh, as he had for other victims whose stories he had told. A sizable chunk of the book advance and royalties would go into it. This was his standard procedure, a practice he kept absolutely out of the press, for the obvious reasons. He chose to withhold this information from Paul Kirkwood as well. Paul had failed the test.
"It's my life. I deserve..." "Inside Edition offered me..."
"Well, I'll tell you what, Mr. Kirkwood," he drawled. "Josh sure as hell deserves better than what he's got." Letting that hang in the air, he crossed the room slowly and rested a hand on the doorknob. "I'll leave my number with your secretary. You can think on it some and call me if you'd like. If you can find time between hard copy and Oprah." Paul watched him walk out, rage curling inside him. Bastard. He could pay lip service to ethics and the integrity of his story, but he wouldn't pay cash. He would rake in $5 million and still had the gall to sneer at the man whose suffering would be an integral part of what would make him that fortune. "I deserve..." Paul refused to feel guilty for thinking it. He did deserve something. He was a victim, too. Even as a part of him insisted on his entitlement, another part of him thought of Josh in the hospital, while another filled with images of that night 2 weeks ago. All of it twisted inside of him until he felt as if he were caught in a whirlpool, sucking him down to drown in panic and remorse. Josh's frantic cries of "No!" echoed in his ears. He pressed his hands over them. Even with his eyes squeezed tight against the images, he could see his son kicking against the hospital bed, felt as if each kick were landing squarely in his belly. A thin cry slipping between his lips, he sank down in the chair behind his desk and doubled over. Shudders racked his body, his mouth twisted open, the chaos in his brain thinned to a single thought. "My son, my son, my son, my son." Then came the guilt. A wall of it. It was the guilt that made him open the bottom drawer of his desk. It was the guilt that had made him keep the answering machine tape from that fateful night. He kept the tape in a microcassette recorder he had bought for dictating letters, but never used. He placed the small black rectangle on the desk, pressed the play button, and Josh's voice spoke to him from the crossroads that had turned all their lives onto a dark path. Chapter 12. "I'm here in Park County to see that justice will be done." Ellen chewed on Tony Costello's words as she drove all the way across town. "As if the state outside the metro area is a lawless frontier," Cameron complained. "And he's Wyatt Earp, come to bring us justice." "It's all part of the show," Ellen murmured, turning onto Lakeshore Drive. "It doesn't bother you?" "Of course it does. Using the Holloman kidnapping and a naked grab for publicity, it's too sleazy for words. But you can't let Tony Costello get to you any more than you let Denny Enberg or Fred Nelson get to you, Cameron. He's just another hired gun." "A hired gun in an Armani suit?" "That's what success will buy you in the big city, Cam, if you're willing to pay the price." "I'm not interested in becoming the next Anthony Costello." "Glad to hear it. The world has more Tony Costellos than it needs." "He doesn't impress me." "Well, he should," Ellen said, turning in at the Kirkwoods Drive. "He's extremely good at what he does. Don't underestimate him, and don't let him get under your skin." She turned the Bonneville off and sat for a moment, looking at the Kirkwoods home, a cedar-sided multi-level that fit in gracefully with its wooded surroundings. Built on the last oversized lot on the street, it had an unrestricted view of the lake to the west. On the north and east, the thick woods of Quarry Hills Park wrapped the property in a feeling of seclusion that must have cost a pretty penny. On the front yard, a half-finished snow fort gave testimony to the normalcy of life in this home before a kidnapper destroyed it. Her eyes lingered on the Wrights' house, two doors down. Ellen heaved a sigh. "Okay, let's get it over with." Hannah answered the door, looking pale and thin. The smile she gave as she invited them in was brittle and quick. "Hannah, this is my associate, Cameron Reed." Ellen pulled her gloves off and stuffed them into her coat pockets. "Yes, I believe we met last summer over a soccer injury," Hannah said, shaking hands with Cameron. He smiled warmly. "I recovered fully, and you were right. The scar is a definite icebreaker at the gym." The smile faded. "I can't tell you how sorry I am for all you and your family have gone through, Dr. Garrison." "Thank you," Hannah replied automatically. "Let me take your coats." "How's Josh doing?" Ellen asked. The brittle smile came and went. "It's good to have him home." "Has he said anything? Given any indication of who took him or where they took him?" Hannah glanced into the family room. Ellen's gaze followed, searching. Josh was nowhere to be seen. "No," Hannah answered at last. "He hasn't said a word about it." "Come in, I've got coffee if you'd like." They followed her through the comfortable family room, with its sturdy, country colonial furnishings and scattering of toddlers' toys, and up the three steps into the spacious kitchen. "I heard about that boy in Campion," Hannah said as she went through the ritual of setting out mugs and pouring the coffee. "I wouldn't have wished that hell on anyone. My heart goes out to the family." "It's all the more incentive for us to build a strong case," Cameron explained. "The more pressure we can bring to bear against our man, the more likely he may be willing to give us his accomplice." Hannah's eyes widened. Her hands were trembling as she set their coffee mugs down. "You're not going to make a deal with him, after everything he's done?" "No," Ellen assured. "No deals. He's going down for all of it. We're hoping Josh will be able to help us nail him. As I explained to you over the phone, Hannah, we want to have Josh take a look at what we call a photo lineup. If he picks our man out of that, we'll want to proceed with an actual lineup at the police station. We felt it would be less traumatic for him to start with the photographs. We don't want to upset Josh, but his ability to identify his abductor would certainly be key to our prosecution." "Will he have to testify in court?" "That will depend on how much he remembers or is willing to tell," Cameron said. "If Josh is able to testify, we'll do everything we can to prepare him so he won't be frightened," Ellen explained. Hannah reached up to toy nervously with an earring. "Couldn't he testify on videotape? I've seen that on television." "Possibly," Ellen said. "There is precedent. I'll talk with the judge when the time comes. But for now, all we want is to have Josh look at photographs. Could you bring him in?" As Hannah left the kitchen, Cameron opened his briefcase, pulled out a sheet of plastic pockets from a photo album, and placed it on the table. "She's not holding up well," he murmured. "I'm sure we can't even imagine what it's been like," Ellen said, keeping an eye peeled for Hannah's return. "I heard their marriage is all but over." "Garrett Wright has a lot to answer for." Hannah herded Josh into the kitchen. Josh eyed them warily. He seemed like an imposter of the boy in the missing posters, with his gap-toothed smile and Cub Scout uniform. The physical resemblance to that boy was there, but none of the sparkle, none of the joy. His eyes looked 100 years old. "Hi, Josh. My name is Ellen." She leaned down to eye level with him. "And this is my friend Cameron. He likes to play soccer in the summer. Do you go out for soccer?" Josh stared at her, silent. His mother ruffled his curly hair. "Josh plays baseball in the summer, don't you, honey?" He looked from Ellen to Cameron, then turned and faced the refrigerator, losing himself in the photographs and school artwork stuck to it with magnets. Hannah knelt down beside him. "Josh, Ellen and Cameron want you to take a look at some pictures they brought with them. They want to see if the man who took you away from us is one of the men in the photographs. Can you do that?" He gave no answer, no reaction of any kind. She turned him gently by the shoulders toward the table. "Just take a look at these, Josh," Ellen instructed, sliding the sheet of photos toward him. "Take your time, and look at all the men. If you see the man who took you, all you have to do is point at him." Ellen held her breath as he bent his head over the pictures, looking at one face, then another. All were mugshots, some of criminals, some of Deer Lake police officers. Garrett Wright's occupied the upper right-hand pocket. Josh looked at them all, his gaze lingering on Wright's face, then moving on.
"All you have to do is point at him, Josh," Ellen murmured. "He's not going to hurt you. We'll make sure he'll never hurt you, or any other kids ever again."
His gaze slowly skated back up across the faces. Then he turned away and went to the refrigerator to stare at a construction paper snowman.
"Josh? Are you sure you didn't see the man?"
Hannah asked, a desperate edge to her voice.
"Maybe you should come back and look again. Come on."
Ellen rose and gently caught hold of her arm before she could drag Josh back to the table.
"It's okay, Hannah. Maybe he just isn't ready to look yet. We'll try it again another day."
"But..." Hannah's gaze darted from her son to the mugshot of Wright.
"It's all right," Ellen said, wishing she felt as nonchalant as she sounded.
"When he's ready, he'll talk about it. He's just not ready yet."
"What if he's never ready?"
she whispered. "We'll make the case," Ellen promised. But as they drove away from the Kirkwood house, she wondered if it was a promise she would be able to keep. Josh was the only witness who could identify Wright and his accomplice. Josh had seen the person who'd picked him up at the hockey rink. The witness, Helen Black, had glanced out her window that night and seen a boy, who could only have been Josh, willingly climbing into a van. He had to have seen who was driving it.
"Maybe the accomplice picked him up," Cameron offered. "Maybe he never saw Wright."
"Maybe." He was silent for half a block as they drove past a Quick Trip and a Vietnamese grocery.
"And if we don't have Josh take the stand, Costello will say he couldn't identify Wright because Wright didn't do it."
"Then we jump all over Costello for being a heartless bastard," Ellen countered. "We say we're not putting Josh on the stand because he's been traumatized and victimized enough. We don't want to put him through the ordeal of cross-examination, to say nothing of having to face Wright in the courtroom."
He nodded as they turned onto Oslo and headed up the hill toward the courthouse.
They passed the knot of protesters on the sidewalk and turned in at the entrance to the sheriff's department lot, swinging around behind the building.
"Poor kid," Cameron said. "It's up to us to get him some justice."
Ellen found a ghost of a smile for him as she palmed her keys.
"That's why they pay us the big bucks, Mr. Reed."
"Judge Rudy Stovich."
Rudy spoke the title aloud to test the sound of it.
Sounded good.
He had occupied this corner office on the second floor of the Park County Courthouse for a dozen years. The oak credenza was piled with file folders and law books he never consulted. His desk was awash with debris. The decorative scales of justice that sat on one corner tipped heavily with golf tees. A set of ping clubs leaned into one dark corner of the room, resting up for the annual February trip to Phoenix, a trip he would gladly postpone in order to move himself into old Franken's chambers.
"Judge Rudy Stovich,"
Manly Van Loon echoed. He plucked a filbert from the nut dish on the desk and cracked it with a tool disguised to look like an angry mallard. Fine slivers of shell rained down like flecks of tobacco onto the front of his tan wool sweater. He was built like a Buddha, all belly and a round, smiling face, his eyebrows tilted up above his tiny eyes.
"Maybe you should go by Rudolph. Sounds more dignified."
Rudy swiveled his chair back and forth, as if the motion would act as a centrifuge and separate the good decisions from the bad.
"Sounds pretentious. Folks like my country lawyer image."
"Good point."
Manly nibbled his filbert, his gaze speculative, as he imagined his pal in judge's robes. He and Rudy had been buddies since snow was cold, backing each other in business ventures and political campaigns.
"How long before the governor makes up his mind?"
"Oh, he'll have to wait a decent interval after they bury old Franken. A week or so, I should think. By the way, the viewing is tomorrow at Oglethorpe's. Funeral Friday, 3:30 at Grace Lutheran."
"Grace Lutheran? All this time I thought he was Methodist. He struck me as a Methodist."
He dusted the filbert shell shrapnel off his cardigan and reached for a pecan.
Dinner? After the funeral? Friday's all-you-can-eat fish at the Scandia house.
Yeah, sure.
Rudy mumbled dreamily, imagining himself delivering a stirring eulogy before a congregation that would include judges and lawyers and politicians from all over the state. Franken had lived a long time, accumulating a long list of powerful friends and colleagues. The funeral seemed a fitting time for Rudy to impress them all with his eloquence and sincerity. The intercom buzzed, and Alice Zemanski's voice snapped out of it like a bolt of lightning.
Ellen is here to see you. I'm leaving.
Send her in.
Rudy forced himself to his feet, though it seemed too late in the day for manners. Once he was firmly ensconced in his judgeship, he was going to give up manners.
Ellen let herself in, manufacturing a smile for Manly Van Loon.
Manly had amassed a small fortune in real estate during the agricultural depression of the 70s, buying out farms on the fringe of Deer Lake and developing the land into pricey subdivisions for the influx of yuppies from the cities. He had then bought a trio of car dealerships and had made himself another fortune, luring car buyers out of the cities with his hayseed image, then cleaning their pockets for them.
Hey there, Ellen.
Manly lifted himself out of his chair no more than he would to fart, and settled back down to the business of digging his pecan out of the shell.
How's that Bonneville running? Heck of a nice car.
Just fine, Manly.
She turned her attention to her boss. I just got a call from the assignments clerk. They're giving Garrett Wright to Judge Grabko. I thought you'd want to know.
Are you all right with that choice?
She shrugged.
We could do worse. Will you recuse?
And let Tony Costello throw a public fit about the prosecution delaying his client's right to a speedy trial, to say nothing of alluding to the maneuver as the tactics of someone with a weak case? He had already made noises on both those points at his 4 o'clock press conference in the courthouse rotunda. Ellen had sent Phoebe to the press conference as her spy, refusing to show up herself and give Tony the golden opportunity of engaging her in some impromptu sparring. When he marched upstairs to the county attorney's offices afterward, with reporters in tow, she made the receptionist lie and tell him she was out, for the sole purpose of spoiling his big moment of confrontation. That small victory had been sweet, but the fact that she was letting Costello affect her decision-making irritated her in the extreme.
Strategy, she told herself.
She had to think in terms of strategy rather than in terms of being manipulated. Always put a positive spin on a negative possibility. Control was the name of the game.
No, I won't recuse Grabko. He knows his stuff. He's fair. I've never had any big complaints about him, other than that he tends toward pretension.
Rudy shot an I-told-you-so look at Manly, who pursed his lips as if holding back a belch.
I'm still amazed Wright got Costello to represent him, Rudy said.
I'd like to know how that happened, Ellen said. Who called him in? Wright isn't allowed to make long-distance calls from jail. I doubt Denny Enberg would have been so gracious as to contact his own successor. Who does that leave?
Wright's wife,
who is barely functioning. I saw her myself the other night. Unless that's all been an act, she could no more have had a coherent conversation with Tony Costello than my golden retriever. That leaves Wright's accomplice.
Which could mean Costello has been in contact with the kidnapper of that Campion boy,
Rudy surmised. And fat chance we'll get him to tell us anything. Rudy made a serious, contemplative sound, arranging his features in an expression he thought would look judicial.
Yes, well, do what you can, Ellen. I'm confident you can handle Costello.
Ellen took the platitude for what it was worth, which was nothing. She left Rudy to his scheming for Franken's seat on the bench and headed back to her own office. The staff was clearing out for the day. Sig Iverson and Quentin Adler were headed out the door, heads bent toward each other as they discussed some point of law or gossip. Phoebe was pulling on her llama poncho over her daisy print dress and thermal leggings. Her head popped up through the opening, and she pulled her mass of kinky hair free.
I put a stack of messages on your desk, she said, straightening her glasses. Mr. Costello called again. Mitch called to say no news is bad news, and that he's going to Minneapolis tonight.
To check on Megan. The thought warmed Ellen, and left her feeling a little empty at once. She leaned a shoulder against her office door and rested her hand on the knob.
Thanks, Phoebe. See you tomorrow.
The secretary frowned at her.
Don't stay too late. You look tired.
I'm fine. Phoebe didn't buy it, but she let it drop. Ellen let herself into her office and picked up the stack of pink slips. She noted the fact that there wasn't one from J. Butler Brooks, and told herself she was glad. Still, she caught herself thinking of the moment just before he had left her house last night, when he had stood a little too close to her and held her gaze with his a little too long.
"You can't avoid me forever."
She wheeled around, half expecting to see Brooks standing there, but the timbre of his voice registered a split second before her eyes focused on the man standing inside the door. The light from the outer office cast him in relief, giving him a menacing darkness that seemed fitting. Tony Costello was a shadow from her past, coming back to haunt her. She reached around and flicked on the desk lamp to break the spell.
"Avoiding you, Tony? As usual, your ego is working overtime. It never occurred to you that I'm a busy woman with more important things on my agenda than playing an obliging role in your media drama."
"Contrary as ever, aren't you?"
he said pleasantly, closing the door behind him. "I was afraid living in the boondocks might have mellowed you." Ellen settled into her chair, slipping her glasses on and pretending attention to the message slips she had yet to set down.
"It has."
She glanced up at him, over the rims of the glasses.
"If you had sneaked up on me like that when I was working in Hennepin County, I would have broken your nose. I've let my self-defense skills slide completely."
"Lucky for me."
He smiled what she knew he considered to be the most charming smile in his arsenal. She remembered it well. Square, white against his dark complexion. A smile he had splurged on to the tune of $15,000, mortgaging the house his parents had left him to pay for porcelain caps. He considered it a business investment. He looked as fit and perfectly groomed as a show horse. The suit today was just a shade bluer than navy, tailored to show off the build he honed in a private gym with a personal trainer. He casually undid the buttons of the double-breasted coat and settled himself easily into her visitor's chair.
"What can I do for you, Tony?"
she asked, with just enough indifference to irritate him. He ignored the bait, his gaze steady on hers.
"It's been a long time."
"Not long enough."
The hurt appeared genuine, but then so had his feelings for her once upon a time.
"You still blame me for what happened with Fitzpatrick," he said. "I was hoping time might have given you some perspective."
"My perspective on criminal tampering with a case isn't liable to change in this lifetime."
He shook his head, frowning.
"How could you believe I would do that, Ellen? Ethics aside, how could you believe I would turn on you that way after everything we'd been to each other?"
"Ethics aside." She gave a harsh laugh and rose again, anger humming in her muscles as she paced the small confines behind her desk.
"Someone feeds Fitzpatrick's side information, virtually off my desk. The case blows up, and the next thing I see is you and Fitzpatrick's attorney palling around."
"We were having dinner. That's not against the law."
"It's certainly not against your law."
"Oh, Jesus, Ellen," he growled, pushing to his feet. "It was a business dinner."
"I'm sure it was."
Ellen advanced toward him. "Did he slide your 30 pieces of silver to you under the table, or did he have the waiter bring it on a platter?"
"There were plenty of people in your own office who had access to that information. Fitzpatrick could have paid off any one of them."
"Yeah. But you know, Tony, none of them was suddenly driving a Porsche, or hanging out at Goodfellows with Gregory Eagleton."
"And of course it never occurred to you that your case blew up because Fitzpatrick was innocent," he shot back. "It never occurred to you that the girl was lying, pressing criminal charges after Fitzpatrick refused to meet her blackmail demands."
The argument touched a nerve that sent a red mist across Ellen's vision. He didn't deny her charges. He diverted attention, tried to shed the blame onto someone else. Pointing a spotlight on the victim crossed the line. She stepped toe-to-toe with him and thrust a righteous finger at him. Art Fitzpatrick raped that girl because he believed his money and his position entitled him to do as he damn well pleased. And the thing that makes me sickest is that he was right. He bought his way out of a conviction, and you sold yourself into his good graces. Then prove it, he shouted. He didn't deny it. He never had. They had been over this ground so many times, they had worn it to dust. Ellen knew she couldn't prove a thing against him. All she'd had were puzzle pieces and a gut feeling that drilled into the core of her. No hard evidence, nothing she could take to the county attorney or to the bar association. At the time, she had racked her brain, trying to come up with a way to punish him, to publicly burn him at the stake, to get him disbarred, to send him to jail. But in the end, there had been only the realization that any such effort would blow up in her face. She would be the one publicly humiliated, scorned, and professionally ruined. She was the prosecutor who had been foolish enough to get involved with an ambitious defense attorney. She had gone into the affair cautious, convinced she was smart enough to handle it. She had come away from it with her self-esteem battered. He had drawn her in, charmed her into believing he had integrity, and just as soon as all her shields were down, he had betrayed her. Nearly 3 years had passed, and still she wanted to cut his heart out. Not because she had loved him, but because he had used her, made a fool of her, mocked the system she prized so highly. She turned away from him and rubbed her hands over her face, trying to clear away the lingering haze of emotion. She didn't want to feel any of it. She especially didn't want to feel it in front of him. Control. Hadn't she just been preaching that word? Hadn't she told Cameron not to let Costello get under his skin? And here she was, going off like a bomb the first time he set foot in her office. "I cared about you, Ellen," he murmured. "Well, it's all in the past tense, isn't it?" she said, sliding down onto her chair. "Ancient history." Tony took his seat in the visitor's chair, like boxers retiring to their respective corners, she thought. The tension dissipated to a tolerable level. "I certainly never meant to drive you from the city," he said. "Don't flatter yourself, Tony," she returned. "You were just a symptom of a much bigger problem. I left Hennepin County because I was fed up to my eye teeth with all the bullshit game-playing. Obviously, you're not content to contaminate just the metropolitan judicial districts. You've decided to take your show on the road." "I'm representing Garrett Wright." "So I heard." Ellen fixed her gaze hard on his face. "And how did that happen?"
"It's a fascinating case."
"High profile, you mean? What I want to know is how you came to be Garrett Wright's attorney. Who contacted you? Or did you come sniffing?"
"Are you accusing me of soliciting a client?" he asked, with a healthy show of affront.
"No, you would never be that crass. So who called you? I know it wasn't Wright himself, or Dennis Enberg."
"You also know I won't discuss this with you," he said, poker-faced. "It's privileged."
Ellen leaned toward him, her arms braced on the desktop. "You think so? If Garrett Wright's accomplice contacted you, if you can reveal to us the identity of the kidnapper of the Holloman boy and do not, I will sink my teeth into charges of obstruction and shake you like a dead rat." Costello smiled like a lover, his dark eyes glowing.
"Ah, you're still my Ellen at heart. Or should I say, at my throat?"
"I never belonged to you, Tony," she said coldly. "I just slept with you. Trust me, it wasn't that big a deal."
"Ouch," he winced. "Hitting below the belt. How unlike you."
"What can I say? You bring out the mean in me. You'll find out the hard way if you're aiding and abetting a kidnapper."
"You're going on the assumption my client is guilty," he said soberly. "I presume him to be innocent, therefore can have no knowledge of an accomplice. I certainly have no knowledge of the Holloman kidnapping."
"God
help you if you're lying to me, Tony.
Ellen said tightly. A child's life could be at stake.
I know what's at stake, Ellen. I always know what's at stake.
He opened his Louis Vuitton calfskin briefcase on the chair beside him and withdrew a sheaf of documents.
Demand for discovery. Since you have virtually nothing on which to base your case, I expect disclosure to happen quickly.
We've got more than enough for the hearing, she said. Your little rush to justice ploy is only going to cramp your efforts, Tony, not mine. Send one of your minions around tomorrow afternoon for the papers.
I'll stop by myself, he said, slipping into his topcoat. Judge Grabko will be hearing my motion to reduce bail. Admirable, the way the district is striving to keep the wheels of justice turning, isn't it?
I suppose you're trying to take credit for the work of our assignments clerk.
Ellen strove to sound bored, as if anyone in this district could care less who you are.
Costello narrowed his eyes. He looked cruel, and she knew he had the potential for it.
I think you could care less, Ellen, he said in a low voice. Let's hope for the sake of the case you don't let your vindictiveness cloud your judgment. I don't want anyone saying it wasn't a fair fight.
She wanted to pick up her paperweight and hurl it at him, but it was out of reach, and restraint dictated a cooler response.
Why don't you take your ego out for a nice big dinner, Tony? The energy it consumes must be tremendous.
His mouth twisted into a thin smile.
As a matter of fact, I am on my way to dinner. I'd ask you to join us, but
I have other plans.
He tipped his head. Until tomorrow.
He stepped into the dim light of the hall, turning back to look at her.
You know, Ellen, he said softly, aside from the circumstances, it really is good to see you again.
Ellen said nothing. When he was gone, she raked her hands back through her hair and blew out a sigh as tension rushed out of her muscles. A logical assessment of their conversation told her it hadn't been a total bust. She had scored some points, held her own. Beyond logic, she felt naked and vulnerable. He had found a way to hurt her before, when she had thought she was invulnerable. She had chosen to walk away, but here he was again, invading her life. No logical argument could take the edge off her uneasiness. And at the heart of that disquiet was not Tony Costello, but Garrett Wright. Why had he chosen Costello? How could he have known the one man she would least want to face in court or out? Who had contacted Costello for him? Who was the other part of us?
As a matter of fact, I am on my way to dinner. I'd ask you to join us.
Possibilities sprang up like mushrooms in her head. He could have been talking about members of his staff, but he might have been referring to the person who had contacted him on Garrett Wright's behalf. Grabbing her coat and briefcase, she hustled out of her office. The purveyors of justice had closed shop for the night, and the dimly lit halls echoed with a hollow, lonely sound of a single pair of heels. She hurried down the stairs, cut across the rotunda, and made for the side door closest to the parking lot. She braced herself for the cold as she pushed through the door, then stood on the step. She scanned the parking lot, looking for Costello, hoping to catch a glimpse of him driving away. But she didn't see anyone. Mumbling a curse under her breath, she started toward her car. She hoped he had gone back to his office first. If she could pick him up there and follow him to the restaurant.
Ms. North?
The dark form seemed to fly out of the shadows like a wraith. Ellen bolted sideways, broke a heel, turned her ankle. Stumbling, she dropped her briefcase. Adam Slater stood stock still, wide-eyed, watching her flounder. The wind blew his hair into his eyes, and he swept it back impatiently.
"Geez, Ms. North, I didn't mean to scare you. I'm really sorry."
Ellen scowled at him. She picked up the amputated heel of her shoe and stuffed it into her coat pocket.
"Mr. Slater," she said, trying to hold her patience, "there really isn't a need to rush at a subject when you are the only reporter in the vicinity."
His lean face contorted into a variety of sheepish looks.
I'm really sorry. It's just that I wanted to catch you before you, well, got away.
Why aren't you in Campion with the rest of the Horde? There's nothing much going on there. I mean, the search, but they haven't found the kid or anything. A bunch of people came back here for Anthony Costello's press conference, but then they went back to Campion for the prayer vigil. I thought I'd hang around, see if I could get a comment from you.
It's better than nothing, huh?
Yeah. I mean, it's something. I mean, what's your take on Dr. Wright bringing in a hired gun like Costello?
He pulled his notebook out of his coat pocket and stood with pen poised. Ellen's breath rolled out in a transparent cloud and billowed up.